Bueno, entonces retomamos el desarrollo del simposio sobre la educación virtual. Viene ahora la intervención de Stephen Brown. Hemos logrado que Diego Leal, que es de colombiano, pero recibía en Brasil, ahora vino a trabajar a la Universidad de Brasil como investigador, estuviera en el acompañamiento por las razones que ya expresé. Es la persona no solo que ha traducido idiomáticamente del inglés al castellano todos los trabajos de Stephen Downs y de George Simmons, los padres del cognitivismo, del conectivismo, sino que ha sido el promotor y intérprete y ha dado aportes al respecto. Y entonces vamos a explicar con él la metodología de la participación y el uso de la tecnología.
Gracias por la invitación, buenos días a todos. Pensando en el tiempo, pensando en el almuerzo libre que se acerca vertiginosamente, queremos proponerles si ustedes ya ven su agenda, en la tarde vamos a tener una hora larga de conversación sobre lo que resulte de esa presentación. Entonces lo que vamos a hacer, queremos proponerles es que escuchemos a Stephen durante este rato que nos queda de la mañana, luego vayamos a almorzar, pero antes de que ustedes se vayan, en las hojitas blancas que tienen, por favor dejen las preguntas y las cosas que surjan de la presentación. De manera que nosotros vemos eso, lo conversamos durante el almuerzo y cuando volvamos podemos tener una conversación un poco más estructurada, ¿vale? Entonces, pues, ustedes van tomando notita y antes de irse, me dejen por favor las preguntas que tengan. Estoy muy acelerado. Con eso dicho ya, pues Néstor hizo la presentación durante la mañana, ¿sí? A mí me agrada mucho el estar aquí acompañándolo porque, como Néstor dijo, o sea, para mí es una persona bien especial. Hace 6 años me encontré con él, siento que cambió mi práctica, definitivamente. Y estoy seguro de que lo que nos va a contar fue mover un montón de ideas en la cabeza. Bueno, quizá un montón de perspectivas o no, pero eso es lo que necesito conversar. Así que, bueno, gracias, Stephen, por acompañarnos y yo va.
Thank you, everyone. Buenos dias. It's a genuine pleasure to be able to be back in Bogota, back in Colombia, and to be able to speak with you today. I have had good memories of my time in Colombia, and I'm adding to those memories with this trip. Today, I want to take you through a bit of a historical journey. We're going to talk about the factors that led to the development of the massive open online course and end of connectivism and of the new phenomena in learning today. But a few preliminaries before I start with the talk. Because it's all about open education. This presentation is available now at that website. The slides are already posted on the website, so you can download them at any time. They're pretty close to what I had here. I was making some last-minute changes during the introductions. There will be audio recording as well on this site. And I know that they are recording video back there, but I always like to do things myself as well. So I'm recording video off of my own computer. And I'm just using Google Hangout, so it's free. And because I can, I'm broadcasting this talk using a YouTube live video stream to people around the world. I have no idea how many people are watching us. Probably not that many. Maybe none. But the idea is that it's possible. Five? Okay, an interruption here. Checking the translation, okay. At the bright side, you will be able to review this later. So, are you able to hear the translated version right now?
No.
Do many people see? Yeah. People know? Okay, I'll stall a little bit. Maybe I'll do a little dance in Colombia. I know better than that. Okay. Online learning begins in the 1980s, it begins in the 1990s, and it's born out of two major things. And like the strands of DNA, we will see these themes repeat through the history of online learning. The first basis is in distance learning. Distance learning is the idea of learning that takes place outside the classroom at any time, at any place. And distance learning, therefore, required the creation and distribution of learning content. Of course, packages that would support independent study. The other basis for online learning is the traditional classroom. Learning that we all grew up with, where there's a class, a cohort of students who go through a body of content or a curriculum, who interact with each other, who conduct activities and conduct projects. So we see the two major sides here. We see the content side and we see the interactivity side. And there are two major pedagogies of online learning that are born out of these two bases. There's a transmission model of learning that is born in Moore's transactional distance theory of distance education. It has its origins in communications theory, and it's about the integrity of the message being sent from the professor to the learner, and being able to be sure that what was received by the learner was the same message that was sent by the professor. We also have a more recent theory, constructivism, which has so many varieties I cannot count and won't try, but is based essentially on the idea of social interaction, negotiation of meaning, finding a common ground, and a model of learning where learners construct their own knowledge. So the content models of distance education, with the course packages and the content, would follow the transmission models, and the class-based interactive models would follow the constructivist model. Now, in the mid-1990s, people began to develop learning management systems, and I'm sure you're all familiar with learning management systems. It's a basis in technology that we all understand and we're all more or less comfortable with. And companies like Blackboard and WebCT and Desire to Learn started companies, commercial enterprises, based on the idea of managing online learning. And they had these two different models. They had the model of the course packages, and they had the model of the classes. WebCT, in English, stands for Web Course Tools. It was intended to be a set of tools that a classroom instructor would use, but it was adapted to distance learning. And in addition to this commercial stream, we had the open source stream, and most especially learning management systems called Moodle, which I'm sure you may be familiar with, and Sakai, which is less common, but was created by a consortium of American universities. Now, we had two models for learning management systems. One model where the company, and Blackboard began this way, would host all of the technology on their site, and you would buy the service from them. Or the other model where you would obtain the software and install it and configure it yourself and host it on your own website. So you see what's happening here. In the 90s already, we're beginning to get the basic building blocks of technology and pedagogy and models of online learning. And for the rest of this talk, you'll see more and more of these building blocks being added and interconnected. As my wife likes to say, it's all a great tapestry. Early online learning featured conferencing, and this, of course, would be the interactivity type of online learning. I remember in the 1990s taking a massive internet course, Welcome to the Internet, and it was delivered by email. And I would sign up for it. It was based on a mailing list, and hundreds, thousands upon thousands of people would receive emails every few days introducing them to a new aspect of the internet. It was my first experience with massive online learning. There are also conferencing systems, early discussion board systems where people would log on and leave messages, similar to the old Usenet technology. But we began to see systems like First Class developed specifically for online learning. These are technologies that may not be familiar to you because they're so old, they've disappeared and have been almost forgotten. But they were important elements in the development of the learning that we have today. And of course, we had instant messaging. I remember using ICQ. In English, it's, I'm not sure of the right word for it, but it's ICQ. ICQ, get it? Very clever. And that was copied by AOL Instant Messaging and Microsoft Messenger. My ICQ number was 1287181. It was one of the earliest. I was so proud I had a low ICQ number, and then the company went away. In that time, things began to be more formalized. And an idea came out, well, partially out of the United States, partially out of Canada, mostly out of the military and the aviation industry, to create something called learning objects. And the idea of a learning object was to package some educational content, digital content, in a standardized way. There was something called LOM, Learning Object Metadata, that was used to describe these objects. And the intent here was to create a system whereby educational resources would be discoverable, shareable, and interoperable, that we could have a common pool of learning resources that these technologies could draw upon. This is a very significant development. And people today say learning objects were a waste. But they were not a waste, because they established the fundamental principles of educational objects, educational resources, and the sharing and distribution of these resources. IMS, Instructional Management Systems, that's a consortium-based, well, mostly in the United States, but with participation around the world, built a series of standards around learning objects. One of these was content packaging. content packaging was a technical way to represent the original distance education course packages. And learning design was an attempt to emulate what was called programmed learning in these course packages, a way of leading the student through the materials one step at a time. It was the idea of managed learning or learning management. Over time, the concept of learning objects and learning object repositories led to the idea of learning object repository networks. And we can picture this really simply in our head. We think of learning objects as like objects, maybe like books, maybe like Legos, maybe like flowers, whatever. And a repository is just a place where we keep a whole bunch of them. And the idea is we create our learning object and we store it in the repository. And over time, as different institutions developed their own repositories, to encourage the idea of sharing, they created repository networks. I spent a number of years in Canada with people from across the country building a repository network called EduSource. EduSource no longer exists, sadly, but the idea was interesting and we learned a lot doing it. One of the things we learned was the tension that exists between open online resources and commercial resources. When you're creating a network of repositories, how do you enable sharing freely while at the same time allowing commercial resources to remain commercial and not just shared the way music was shared? And you know, this was early 2000, 2001, 2002. Content producers looked at things like Napster and music sharing and they were having heart attacks. And one of the reasons why our repository network failed was because of the constraints that commercial publishers wanted to place on it. You know, there's a fundamental dichotomy between open content sharing and commercial markets, and that's what we were experiencing in repository networks. There were also open content repositories developed around this time. The Open Archives Initiative created software and a set of specifications for uploading and downloading objects from repositories. That was taken by MIT and turned into something called DSpace. And that exists even to this day. It's used mostly for academic publications, not so much for learning objects or learning resources. That's because academic publications is a big industry, learning resources, not a big industry. So far, so good?
Yep.
Excellent. You can see it's like a story, right? We progress through, and bit by bit, we're adding elements to the mix here. So, it's important to see this not just as a history, but as a cataloging of the elements that are going into contemporary online learning. And here's another major element. And this element was developed around the same time as learning management systems and around the same time as learning objects. And that is the idea of learning communities. I remember doing a talk about Etienne Wenger and mispronouncing his name the whole way through. It was so new to me. That was the first talk I recorded on audio, so the evidence follows me to this day. Sometimes there are mistakes you cannot escape. But the concept of a community of practice is important. And it actually has its origin in the philosopher Thomas Kuhn, who talked about networks of researchers who share a common paradigm. And Kuhn is most famous for the idea of scientific revolutions. But equally important, I think, is his characterization of what he called normal science. And what normal science is, and I should probably put it in quotation marks, what normal science is not simply the facts and the data related to a discipline. Physics, the discipline of physics, is not simply a bunch of formulas. But it's the vocabulary, it's the interaction, it's the shared assumptions, it's a common understanding of what evidence is important and what evidence is not important. It's the dialogue, it's the feel for what it is to be a physicist. Kuhn used to say that the knowledge of being a physicist isn't the material at the front of the chapter, it's knowing how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. It's a way of seeing the world. And being able to solve the problems is demonstrating that you see the world in the right way. And this is a kind of learning that is generated not through transmission, not even through knowledge construction, but through something else. So the idea of communities of practice is important, and a fundamental building block to the concept of learning that we have today. And like everything else, there were the, what would we call them, open communities of practice. These were so informal, there's almost no history of them. And then there were the more commercialized communities. I remember being hired by the University of Alberta to create a commercial community of practice called MuniMall. And it was modeled on a book called Net Gain by Hegel and Armstrong. And the idea of this online community was that it would be like a shopping mall. A shopping mall of physics. Or in my case, a shopping mall of municipal governance. And the idea was that content providers would share their resources, or more accurately, sell their services and their resources. And participants, people who work in that community, would interact with each other. The interaction part of MuniMall worked really well. And in fact, the community lasted for 10 years from the original design. The commercial part, not so much. Interesting lessons here. So, as we began to see more of these initiatives, we began to see learning objects, we began to see online communities that look like shopping malls, we began to see content packaging. There was a stream of thought based on the idea of open source software, based on the idea of open sharing and open content. And it came over time to be called open educational resources. This name, open educational resources, was formalized by UNESCO in the early 2000s. But the idea represents educational content that is shared openly. David Wiley came up with an early version of open content and an open content license. And the idea here is that a person or a company or a university would create an educational resource, like a learning object, but maybe not a learning object. We don't need to be that particular. And would attach to it a license that allows it to be shared freely. So the resource has two parts, the content of the resource and the license. A major initiative that supports open educational resources, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, is Creative Commons. And in just the same way, Creative Commons is a way of attaching a license to a piece of content to allow that content to be freely shared. And this is really important. And it's really important because the default assumption for content is that content is privately owned and cannot be shared. In my mind, that's the single largest barrier to open learning that exists today. The default assumption that open learning is illegal. And so we need the licensing to make open learning legal. If it was up to me, it would be the other way around, right? If it was up to me, content would be free by default. But if you attach the license to it, then it would be commercial. But people don't agree with me on this. It's interesting, though, and you know, I look sometimes at the roots of open content licensing and Creative Commons and think that open licensing and Creative Commons come out of the same place, for that matter, that open source licensing comes out of, places like Berkeley, places like Stanford, places like MIT. I visited MIT to give a talk and saw Richard Stallman's office, and with a paper handwritten his name on the door, because he's not that permanent. But it's interesting that this perspective, that the default is commercial and the exception is open, has its origin in these major commercial American universities. We will come back to that thread. Now, my involvement in open educational resources, aside from producing them, producing photographs, producing recordings, whatever, was in the area of sustainability, and I did a study for OECD on models of sustainability of open educational resources. And this is where the thread of sustainability enters the picture. Hasn't been in the picture so far. We've had the thread of open resources versus commercial resources, or open source software versus commercial software. So now we have this idea of sustainability, which is almost like a middle ground. And the core idea of sustainability is, if you have, or if you want to produce open educational resources, how do you pay for them? That's a good question. And I analyzed two different models of sustainability that existed at the time. This is a quick summary. That picture looks much nicer on my screen. It's a folded hand with a tick plant. I love the contrast. One model, and this is a model, it's actually in the field of academic publishing. It's called the gold model, and it's a model where the author pays a fee in order to publish the resource, and then the publisher makes the resource available. And there are some journals, academic journals, that operate along this principle. I don't know of any educational resource initiative that operates on this principle, because I haven't seen a big willingness on the part of people who create educational resources to pay for their publication. But you know, it happens informally a lot. I pay for my own website, for example. So in a way, that's an author pay system, right? People pay for their own internet access. That's kind of like an author pay system. There's certainly an element of author contribution here. And, you know, the size of that element of author contribution tells us how accessible the market to create open educational resources is for people. People don't often think about that. Another model, which is very popular in the United States, is the foundation model. You have the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, you have the Wellcome Trust, you have the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. There's also one called Shuttleworth Foundation, and there are many other foundations. And what these foundations do is contribute money to develop the development of learning resources. The thing with the foundation model is foundations run out of money, or foundations stop providing money. So when you're funded by a foundation, you are always faced at the end of this funding with the question now of how do you become sustainable? And about half the time what happens is the open educational resource becomes a commercial resource. I just spoke with David Wiley. He was involved with a company called Flat World Knowledge. And Flat World Knowledge was started with foundation money, and it was intending to publish learning resources for free. They would make their money on the printed version. But only recently, Flat World Knowledge announced they would no longer publish learning materials for free. They would now be a fee, but they would be competitively priced. This is a pretty common sort of thing. Here's the public service model, and that's actually mostly my model. That's where government pays for the cost of the infrastructure and the cost of ongoing support. And so it is very similar to the public broadcasting model. I don't know if there's a public broadcaster. Is there a public broadcaster in Colombia? There is. It's one of these things I should check before I do my talk. In Canada, we have the CBC, which is publicly funded radio, television, and internet broadcasting. Just as an aside, it should be available here. If you want to hear great new Canadian music, go to CBC Radio Free. Fabulous. I hope it's available here. I listen to it all the time. It's all independent Canadian music. It's like the open educational resources of Canadian music industry. Just, I love it. Okay, that's an aside. Finally, there's the community model. And the community model is really important because the community model taps into the idea of the community of practice. And it taps into the idea of the people who consume, to use a bad word, that consume the resources are also the people who produce the resources. And in the end, this is the model that I recommended to OECD, who, being a commercial organization, promptly rejected it. But the model is that people create their own educational resources. People create their own educational communities. And one of my major arguments for this is, it's in the long term, it's the only truly financially sustainable model, is the community-based model of resource production. Any other model, I think, will eventually lead us to a commercial model. So we have now this other piece of the puzzle. And around that time, things really became interesting. Because the idea of consumers producing their own content was found not only in, in learning, but in the web as a whole. In English, there's a term prosumer. It's a combination of the term producer and consumer. Right. Is there a similar term in Spanish? Sorry? Prosumidor?
Prosumidor.
I'll work on the pronunciation of that after the talk. But and what was happening, this is happening around the middle of 2005, 2006, was that people were now gaining access to websites and web services that allowed them to create their own content. These are all sites you're familiar with. Blogger, right? Blogging exploded. Maybe people don't talk about blogging so much now, but there's a lot of blogging happening right now. YouTube, right? Remember when YouTube, everything was YouTube? YouTube was going to change the world? It actually did change the world in many ways. I'm using YouTube now. Hi, YouTube people. A site I use a lot to store photos, because I take a lot of photos, is Flickr. Right? And it's interesting because these content sharing sites adapted an innovation that was created by the instant messaging services. Remember I talked about ICQ? The way ICQ worked was you have a list of friends. AOL called them buddies. Typical AOL casual language. I don't know what MSN Network called them, because I've never used MSN Network. But the idea is, you would have a list of friends. And when we started using systems that allowed us to create our own content, like blogging systems, we imported this idea. The original version of it in blogging was something called the blog roll. I don't know if there's a Spanish word for that, but in English it's blog roll. It's a list of blogs that you read. But also in other things, content sharing sites like what became to be called social networks, the list of friends almost became more important. But what you had was a combination here of content creation and the list of friends. And everybody focuses on the social of social networking, but the content creation is equally important. Facebook is the world's largest repository of photographs. People don't realize that. Well, they should, because they've been uploading them like crazy. Content sharing network like Twitter, borrowing from SMS, which is why they use 140 characters. And with these kind of services comes a bit of an evolution in our understanding of what a website actually is. It used to be all about presenting content. That was Web 1.0. That was old learning. That was the content-based paradigm. But Web 2.0 became about interaction and communication. And it made us think about content a bit differently. Content, very importantly, became data. Content was something that you stored in a database and then presented in different ways, or shared, or manipulated. Around this time, there was what was called the mashup. And the mashup, what you would do is you take content from one database and content from another database and mash it up. So you would take Google Maps, for example, and a list of every Starbucks and create a map with all the Starbucks on it. Which I never used because I hate Starbucks. In Canada, we have Tim Hortons coffee. I understand you have coffee there, too. A little coffee, although I never find it. And what's interesting is these websites became places not only where you shared data, they became places where you manipulated data and created new data. So websites actually became like little programs, like little applications. There was a slogan, the web as platform. That phenomenon is still very much at work today. Every website you go to, almost, is a platform of some sort. Different platforms, different ways of doing things. But what they are all doing is interrelating data. All of them. Except old websites that were created in 1995 and nobody did anything with them since. So here's what I worked on. And this is just a version of Web 2.0. A version of the whole idea. But what I would do is I would take data from different websites in a data format called RSS. And all you need to know about RSS is it's content computers can read. That's all you need to know. And I would take that content and I would use my computer programs to join it. And use my computer programs to filter it and produce output. So that's pretty handy. I could, for example, and I did, create a single feed, which is what the output is called, is a feed, a single feed of all the content about a certain subject. I have one, you can look at it now, it's running here now, look, I'll do it right now, listen to me right now. Called www.moot.ca. And it looks like a great site that I write every day, but I don't. I read it, it's pretty interesting, but I don't do a thing to create it. It's just aggregated content on the subject of MOOCs joined together and then output as a newsletter. So, this is an incredibly powerful technology. I cannot emphasize how powerful this technology is because it puts into the hands of people the capacity to create authoritative web resources. The capacity to bring resources from wherever they may be on the internet and create a single resource. Or the capacity to create a single web page that is dynamic, that is always current, and draws on data from different places. If you go look at a weather page on the internet, they operate in the same way. Exactly the same way. There are hundreds of weather stations around the world, and they pull these weather stations. The content is in a certain code. They decode the content, and then they present the information. That's how weather sites work. This leads us directly to the concept of connectivism. And you see how easy a move this is? We've gone from connecting content, to connectivism. Because the idea here now is that you have all of these resources, all of the content produced by all of the people on their blogs, on YouTube, in Flickr accounts, wherever. And you have all of these people with lists of their friends in social networks maybe, or as email contact lists or whatever. So they create this network. And we have the technology now, finally, to join all of these things together. And connectivism is the theory of education that you come up with when you think about how education can work using this connected technology. Now, the term, of course, derives from George Siemens, who wrote an important paper called Connectivism. And he describes connectivism pretty much as a pedagogy. The phrase, I store my knowledge in my friends, is one of the slogans from his original characterization. And the idea is that I do not need to memorize everything I know. I don't need to know everything I know. I simply need to know where to find it. And it's a new type of skill. It's the skill of creating networks and traversing networks. It's a new kind of understanding. My contribution to connectivism is the depiction of knowledge as a network state. And what I mean by that very precisely is to know something is to be in a certain connected state. And that's kind of a hard concept in one sense, but it's an easy concept in another sense. To know something, on my theory, is to be able to recognize it. That's how I know Diego when I see him. Now, I think he doesn't wear a name tag, although if he did, that's what I would recognize. But I look at him, I see his face, I go, and sorry, I'm just kidding. And I recognize him. That's how a physicist solves the problem at the end of the chapter. The physicist looks at the problem and recognizes, oh, it's that kind of problem. But what is that recognition? What is that capacity? We, as humans, are composed of a network as well. It's a neural network. We have, I don't know, 100 billion neurons. These neurons are all connected to each other. To learn is to create those connections between neurons. To know something is to have a certain set of connections. So what happens, technically and literally, when I recognize Diego, certain connections fire in my brain. Those connections were created from previous experiences. That's how I created them. Right? I got out there, I went to Colombia, I saw Diego, walked around, I talked with him for a while. I'm not very good with faces, so it took several visits. And I formed the neural networks in my mind. And what's interesting about connectivism is societies learn that way too. And societies have knowledge that way. And this is what George was seeing. George was seeing social knowledge. I see personal knowledge. It's two different kinds of knowledge, but it's the same, it's created the same way. In society, we connect people. And we connect objects, like learning objects, like flowers, like maps, like YouTube videos, like photographs, like pictures of my cat. We connect all of these together. What a society knows is expressed by those connections. Society learns by creating new connections. And there is some knowledge that only a society can have. It's knowledge so large, so complex, no individual person can have it. There's examples all around us of that kind of knowledge. Look at this room. Could any of you, or any one person, build this room? Not possible. Nobody can know that much, especially if you include the computers and the software on the computer and all your clothing and all the wiring and the lighting systems and the translation booth and the knowledge of two languages to make that work. No one person could do it. But collectively, or maybe more accurately, cooperatively, all of us together, through interaction, create the knowledge that is represented by this work. This phenomenon of creating knowledge in an object is called stigmergy in English. I have no idea what that would be in Spanish. I think I even stumped Diego. But it's the same sort of thing that ants do. An anthill shares knowledge one ant to the other by creating physical artifacts. A scent, a tunnel, an object left behind. That's how ants communicate, using objects. So we have this picture of connectivism. We have this picture of learning as connecting, as knowledge, as a network of connections. We have this idea of learning as immersion into an environment, right? Because what we want to do, what we want to happen is for people to recognize. And we know that you cannot create recognition just by telling people things. You cannot create recognition just by describing. Well, sometimes people can recognize me by description, but generally, it doesn't work very well. In order to recognize, you need to be in the situation. You need to be practicing with the materials that you want to be able to recognize, or with the type of material. There's a whole complex series of connections or inferences that you make. Jay Cross characterized this as informal learning. And what is informal learning? Informal learning is learning you conduct for yourself through your interactions in a community. And that's a model that should by now in this talk sound very familiar. What Jay is adding with the concept of informal learning is that now there is no structure, now there is no organization, now there is no professor. People learn for themselves and they design their own learning. And this was demonstrated, and I thought demonstrated very effectively in the EDU camps that Diego put on, and I helped with here in Colombia, and it's a model that's been replicated elsewhere, where the idea is you bring people together, and you don't have a formal agenda of first we'll learn this, first then we'll learn this, then we'll learn this, but what you have scattered around in a room are different stations, and people who have knowledge go to these stations and share that knowledge. And people who need knowledge go to these stations and listen to the people who have knowledge. Except they don't just talk and listen, they actually have whatever it is that they're interested in right in front of them. So they can learn to create blogs by creating blogs. Learn to record audio by recording audio. And the structure is not defined. There's this concept, and this is what EDUCAMPS come out of, this concept of conferences generally called bar camps. And a bar camp is simply a room, or a series of rooms, and a starting time. And you say, we will have a bar camp at such and such a place at such and such a time. And you might suggest a topic, online learning, audio recording, high definition photography, whatever. And people arrive in the room, and if they have something they would like to share, they write it up on the wall. And if people are interested in learning about that, they sign up for it. And if you put something up on the wall and nobody signs up for it, that's fine. You go somewhere else and you learn from someone else. And there's no preset structure here. And the idea of one of these bar camps is whatever we talked about was the right thing to talk about. Whatever the outcome was the right outcome. It's the idea that when people interact together in this kind of environment, in this learning environment, they are able to self-organize. They are able to prioritize their own learning. It's a very interesting and different educational experience. And it gets you right into the community that you're trying to learn about. The technological equivalent of the bar camp is the personal learning environment. And this is something, this is a diagram by Scott Wilson, who works in Great Britain. And the idea of the personal learning environment is that you treat the entire world as your learning environment. And then you connect to different kinds of resources. You can connect to blogging sites, photo sites, learning management systems, to-do lists, videos, your own website, Facebook, Twitter, whatever you want. The actual technology is RSS, or other standards similar to RSS. The same sort of bringing together of content that I described earlier happens in a personal learning environment. And learning as a whole in this model becomes a network created by hundreds, thousands, millions of individual personal learning environments. Our learning network is each one of us connected to our list of friends, our list of learning resources, our list of activities, connecting to them, making new connections, interacting, creating this new knowledge by this interaction, by creating these connections. Into that mix now comes the idea of open courses. And if you think about it, here's our personal learning environment. Here's a learner, a student, a person who wants to learn. All of these around the students are open educational resources. And if you organize them a little bit, or even just create an environment for them here and call it a course, now we have an open online course. The idea here is that an open online course is composed of, well, we'll come back to that, whatever a course is composed of. But the important thing is that it is open, that anybody in the world can access that course without paying money, without filling in a form, giving your email address and your telephone number and your dog's birthday. Open courses have a long history. Open courses began to exist in the idea of open courseware, created by MIT. Yes, the same place that we got Creative Commons licensing from. And we get a number of initiatives, MIT OpenCourseWare, and then there's the OpenCourseWare Consortium of various universities producing the same thing. And what this is all the materials that you would need in a course, the readings, the curriculum, the problem sets, very important, maybe some videos, etc. Connections is the same thing. It was created at Rice University, and what they did is they created an environment that course authors can enter and use to create their open courses. It's pretty innovative. A lot like Blogger, only for courses. OpenLearn is an initiative of the Open University of Great Britain, still exists, very important, very widely used, that has complete course packages. You remember at the start of this talk, I talked about the two models of distance education, and one model was the content model. This is the 21st century version of that model. It is a self-standing course package. It programs learning. It takes you step-by-step through the material. So we have the commercial models. We have the publicly supported models. We also have the sharing or open source models. I mentioned three here. Wiki Educator, Kirichi, and Wikiversity. They are all initiatives that use a wiki, which is simply a website that anybody can read and anybody can edit. And they use these websites to create courses or to create curriculum. The model they follow is Wikipedia, only they use the Wikipedia model. Instead of creating an encyclopedia, they create courses. Good idea. David Wiley, remember him, created a wiki for his course in open education. It's a course that he taught at Utah State University and later on at Brigham Young University. And the idea that he had was to make the course materials that he was offering his class not just readable, but editable by anybody. So I went in and wrote a whole bunch of his classes for him. Well, I didn't write the whole class, but I wrote bits and pieces and added stuff and gave myself all kinds of credit. Just kidding. Alex Koros, who's an instructor in Saskatchewan, Canada, launched open courses, and what he did is he opened up his online communications environment. He was using, and still uses, I think, a product called Illuminate. Today it's called Blackboard Collaborate. But what he did is he said, I'm having my course in Illuminate at such and such a time. My class from here in Saskatchewan will join me. And anyone else in the world who wants to join me can do so as well. That was pretty cool. Because now what happened is people from around the world were sitting in on Alex's classes and interacting and discussing the topic of the day. And if you think about it, it was like it was a way of giving the students in his class a way to become a part of that wider community they wanted to learn about. Because now, instead of just talking to each other, they started talking to experts around the world. That also happened in David Wiley's class. Now, instead of just getting content from the professor, they were getting content from anywhere around the world. And what's really cool here, I think, is by opening the content and opening the interaction, we're almost able now to blend these two major threads of distance learning, the content and the interaction. By opening them both, we can make them both work together, just in the same way we did in eLearning 2.0, just in the same way we did in things like the EdChamps and informal learning. But now we're doing this in an institutional environment. The very first, and these came to be called massive open online courses. And when you first look at them, they're a horrible mess. But what they are really is a combination of all of the things that I've been talking about so far in this talk. All of the different pieces of the puzzle come together to form these massive open online courses. The very first MOOC was hosted by George Siemens and myself. It was called Connectivism and Connective Knowledge, and we launched it in 2008. And this picture is a representation created by one of the students in the class. It was a representation of the class. We didn't do this. We couldn't do this. And the idea here of MOOCs is to take the concept of open content, the concept of open interaction and open community, and the concept of open classes, and to bring them all together. And that's exactly what we did. We offered it out at the University of Manitoba. It was a credit course, and the students who were enrolled in the University of Manitoba needed to do some assignments. That was one. And we opened it up to anyone in the world, and we had 2,300 people join us. And that was a bit of a surprise to us. That's when open online courses became massive open online courses. How did we design this? Remember, we are creating a network. And remember that to learn is to create a network. Knowledge is the state of a network. So I ask, what constitutes successful knowledge, successful networks? That's a good question. We all know about networks that can fail. The power grid is a network. When you have a blackout, it fails. Right? The community of people is a network. When a disease comes through and wipes out half the population, that's a failure. These things are called cascade phenomena. And what it is the network is affected by a force that attacks every entity all at once. And it leads to stagnation and network death. A viral idea or a piece of propaganda is a cascade phenomenon. You have an idea, it can be something simple like a tune, like a Shakira tune maybe. They were pretty viral. And, you know, one person says it, and then two people, and four people, and eight people, and eventually everybody's singing, I don't know, Dicks Don't Lie or Macarena or something. We call them earworms. Or, you know, an idea like racism. Is again one of these viruses that starts in one place and it can spread through society. That's a cascade phenomenon and it's an example of network failure. You need to design networks so that they can grow, so that they can adapt, so that they can change, so that they can learn. Just the same way as humans. You need to design humans in the same way. So if you don't get to design humans, it's hard. And you don't really get to design societies either. They're too large for one person to design. But what you do is you can design the pieces that go together. You can design the properties that, when combined, will lead to an effective network. And I outline those in what I call the semantic principle. Sorry about the name. What these are my idea of principles of a successful network. I don't pretend that they're necessarily true or that all of these and only these work, but they are what I see at this point in time from my vantage point. Autonomy, diversity, openness and interactivity. Diversity. You think about a network, you think about a successful network, A successful network is made of pieces that are different from each other, not the same. Imagine you had a conversation where everybody said the same thing. Imagine you had a debate where everybody had the same idea. These would not be productive. They would not lead to anything new or interesting. Networks need diversity. Networks need individuals with different points of view. One of the things that we really tried to promote when we designed our MOOCs was to promote the idea that people would read different things and not the same thing. So we did not have a single assigned text. We had 100. And nobody could read 100 texts. But you would pick and choose from those texts, and then everybody would have a different perspective. And that's how we had interesting conversations. Openness. We need to be open to new information. Closed systems become stagnant. Closed systems literally choke on their own waste. The system has to have input, it has to have output. Raw materials that come in, finished product that goes out. The idea here is for any communication to happen, there needs to be an open flow from one entity to the next entity. This is why so often we find openness in conflict with commercialization. Because commercialization very often, not always, but very often is based on the model of closing what was previously open. Autonomy. This is a hard principle for many people to accept, but it's the idea that each individual manages his or her own learning. As John Stuart Mill said, each person in a society pursues his own good in his own way. And this is essential to produce diversity. It is essential to produce communication and interaction. It is essential to support learning. If you do not have autonomy, then the knowledge of one becomes the knowledge of everyone. And if the one is corrupt, then everyone is corrupt. Autonomy is what protects the system from cascade phenomena that damage the network as a whole. Finally, interactivity. And this is the idea that I was talking about earlier, that knowledge is created by the interaction between the members. It's really important to think of this because in traditional learning, remember the transactional theory of learning, Moore, the knowledge is in the head of the professor and then will be put into the head of the student. This model doesn't work that way. In this model, knowledge is created by the interactions. When we interact with each other, we as a group, or maybe not a group, but we as a network, will create knowledge that only the networks could create because it's too large for any one individual. And then each individual in the network will look at that knowledge that we created and learn their own thing from it. Right? All of us together form a society. That society is greater than any one of us. And then each of us individually draws an individual meaning, individual knowledge from that society. That gives us a story about MOOC pedagogy. That gives us a story about self-directed informal learning where the process is important rather than the content. Where the emphasis is on selecting these resources, finding these resources, creating them, mashing them up, mixing them, using them to communicate with each other. The pedagogy of MOOC is the pedagogy of immersion into a community, of interaction with that community. The technology supporting the MOOC is the technology that has been used to support, well, these learning object repositories, these social networks and social networking sites, these individual places where you can create content, these RSS systems that join content together. Think about the sorts of content repositories you have now. One famous content repository, and that's all it was called the Khan Academy. All the Khan Academy was, originally, was a bunch of YouTube videos. Very badly done. But well enough done that they worked. Right? They weren't produced by a professional corporation. They were produced by some guy who knew a little math and physics and wanted to share. That was our learning object repository, except they're not formal, institutionally created objects anymore. It's a community-based model. When it began, Khan Academy was a community-based model. Then the Gates Foundation got a hold of him, and it's not community anymore. We've moved into a different model, which will eventually lead, in my mind, to commercialization. There are different technologies. There's a huge, huge range of technologies today for creating, updating, polling, and sampling these repositories. I mentioned SWORD, which is a deposit protocol, a way to contribute content to a repository, CORE, which is a way to connect repository, and so on. This talk is too short to allow me to even begin to list these, but trust me, there is a lot of technology for creating and linking repositories. And the really interesting work that's about to begin, that is beginning, is our ability to build personal learning environments and MOOCs that tap into these repositories. This is software I built in order to do this task. It's called Grasshopper. And the model is really very simple. You get input from community and input from content. You put it into a database. You turn your content into data. You mix it and mash it up. And then you send it forward as email newsletters, as web pages, or as RSS or other feeds. That will feed into somebody else's Grasshopper. This is also a model of the activity that individuals are expected to perform when they take a MOOC. Aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. That is the pedagogical design of a MOOC. At least the MOOCs the way we create them. In this environment, we are working with open content, and it works best with open content. You see, as soon as you put a barrier, then your aggregation or remixing begins to fail, right? But we also opened not just the content, we opened the instruction itself. We opened the way we organized our courses. We planned our courses in a wiki. And we opened up the course sessions. So we used Illuminate. We did 2 sessions a week. We had several hundred people at first join these. We got kind of chaotic, but that was fun. Different degrees of openness lead to different types of open educational resources and different kinds of open courses. James Taylor, or Jim Taylor, from the University of Southern Queensland, has come up with what he calls a logic model, which is neither logical nor a model. I'm kidding. But talking about different aspects of openness, accessing open educational resources, accessing open support via volunteers. This is what I would call accessing the community, interacting with the community. Open assessment. And this is the next stage in these open online courses, is open assessment. And then finally, open credentialing, open degrees. There are degrees of openness here beyond what we have experienced thus far. We've begun to explore them in the MOOCs that we've done following up. In CCK09, our second MOOC, much to our surprise, the students from CCK08 came back. And then, even more to our surprise, they started teaching the course. And so we had competing teachers in the same course. It was all very interesting. Jim Groom's course, DS106, and I could do a whole talk on that, several talks, had an emphasis on projects and creativity. DS stands for digital storytelling. And it's about how you use different media to tell stories. And they explore the different types of media and the different ways of telling stories. He opened that up, and what he opened up was the list of assignments that you give students. He said, I don't want to be the one to decide on the assignments. You, to the world, you come up with assignments, and then the students will do them. They'll pick and choose, of course. So people from all around the world suggested different assignments, and it became creative chaos. It was amazing. It was wonderful. Another course we did was critical literacies that focused on the underlying skills. Because one of the common comments we have is that people need to have certain literacies, certain basic abilities in order to be able to learn for themselves. So I, in a colleague of mine, Rita Top, asked, well, could we use a MOOC to teach people how best to use a MOOC? Could we use a MOOC to help people learn these basic skills? It's still inconclusive, I think, although we learned a lot. But you know, I started in 1995 with something called Stephen's Guide to the Logical Fallacies, which was my first open content. And this whole idea of critical thinking and of critical reasoning has been something interesting to me over the years. This is the latest phase of that. And I think, personally, that we can indeed use distributed open online learning in order to foster the skills needed. Because we need to think of this, right, as a process where people learn through immersion, and they can learn good argumentation through immersion. They can learn how to spot good resources through immersion. It's exactly how somebody learns how to make a salad or cook a steak. Right? You put them in a kitchen, you tell them to do things, they begin to do things, they watch the master chef, and eventually they become one. And it's the same with critical thinking. It's the same with critical literacies. After we had been doing MOOCs for 3 years, commercial MOOCs came on the scene. The first one that was launched was the Stanford AI course last year. And it attracted, I don't even know what the real numbers are, but something like 160,000 registrations. I think something like 40,000 people finished the course. I don't know. Different sources have different numbers, but the main message here is the numbers are huge. And then there were commercial spin-offs from this based on models like the Khan Academy. based on, very much in my mind, on the traditional LMS model, but the idea is they would be MOOC companies. They would offer courses that were very similar to the Stanford AI course. But now, the Stanford AI course was not a MOOC the way we did it. The Stanford AI course was the course materials and the course sessions open and accessible online. And then assignments were given, and what they added to the mix that I thought was really interesting was automated evaluation of submitted assignments. But I find it very interesting that this model of content-focused MOOCs, which is what these are, they're content-focused MOOCs, there is no element of community in them, these models come out of the same places as Creative Commons, as MIT OpenCourseWare. They come out of MIT, Stanford, Harvard, the large commercial U.S. universities. And so there's a certain way, a certain approach that they have. So now we're in a world of MOOCs. And certainly in my world, and maybe in your world, when I read about educational technology today, everyone is talking about MOOCs. MOOC this, MOOC that. We offered a MOOC on the future of higher education. I've got a website, well, there it is again, www.mooc.ca. If you go to that, you will find links to hundreds, maybe thousands of MOOCs. MOOCs of the connectivist model that we used, we call them CMOOCs. MOOCs of the MIT Stanford Nexus, or XMOOCs. MOOCs that are network-based, like the ones that George and I built. MOOCs that are task-based, like Jim Groom's DS106 with all the projects and assignments. MOOCs that are content-based, like Stanford AI, like Coursera, like Udacity, like Khan Academy. The future of MOOCs, I'm really sorry about this diagram, that's me drawing by hand inside the Illuminate environment, but it's a visual representation of the future of MOOCs. At the center, because there is a historical origin for this, are the content-based ex-MOOCs. Around that center is the network, the community of practice, the interaction and participation, all of the elements that went into making the scene, the individual creations, the sharing, the aggregation, remixing, repurposing, feed forward. None of that is in the center. All of that happens outside the center. In a university context, none of that's in the university. All of it happens outside the university. Outside the CMOOC are the web services that people use. Twitter, Facebook, RSS, Google+. Hi, Google+, people. Delicious. And then outside all of that is open assessment. Open assessment may be prior learning assessment. It may be open assessment, as in Indira Gandhi National Open University. It may be testing. There's a site called Brain Bench that does online testing. It may be Mozilla badges. This is the least well-defined yet. But you can see this ecosystem beginning to form. This ecosystem is the future of online learning. So, where are we going? I'm almost done this talk. This is the good part. So, hang up your phone. What's coming very soon, maybe even tomorrow, who knows, I don't know, but soon, open educational apps. Of course, right? And based on the app store model. What is the app store? The app store is an object repository. That's all it is. Oh, with the checkout counter, because it's commercial. But, you know, we're moving to an environment where, you know, especially with the Android Play Store and things like that, where there are open apps already. There will be a network of open educational apps. Publishers will distribute commercial applications. If you're wondering about the future of the book becomes the e-book, becomes the app. So instead of buying a physics textbook, you will buy a physics app. But that's the content, right? You still need the community around that. And so MOOCs will access these app repositories. People will use different apps, but then they will begin to use them to create, to interact, and to share. That's why you need open apps, so everybody can use them. These, in turn, as they get more and more interesting educational content, will be supported by things like IMS's learning technology integration. And all that is language that allows one app to launch another app. Remember back in the 1990s, we used to have launchers. Now we have learning technology interaction. And the idea is that if you have a learning resource and you access it on MyMOOCs and the learning resource wants to start a chat, you use LTI and it starts the chat. And if you use it, the same resource on a different MOOC, you use LTI and you launch a different chat. It's a bit complicated. Well, it's a lot complicated, but in essence, it is a way one thing can launch another thing the same way, even though it's not the same as the first thing. That wasn't clear at all. It's an app launcher. And with the app launcher in MOOCs, an open app market will emerge. Here's the same concept represented visually. Because you see how bad a text-based explanation is. You have all of these different kinds of systems, your learning management systems that I talked about at the start, MOOCs, and they use something like a launcher, LTI, to launch, illuminate, or big blue button, or a PHP application, or perhaps a spreadsheet, a widget. The idea here of LTI is that it is connecting distributed applications to educational environments. The next step is we move beyond the idea of standalone courses at all. This is already beginning to happen. And when it hits, it's going to be this huge wave. Right now, the model is a course belongs to a university, or a course belongs to a college, or a course belongs to a school. But what if it didn't? What if the course was just out there? And then the university accessed the course as an external resource. Well, that's what's happening. And what's happening is, and that's what the Coursera model is, right? Except they have a very narrow definition of course. But basically, you have a course, and then all of these university partners access this course. But if you have one course being accessed by a university, why not by two universities? Why not by three universities? And even better, why not have the people at one university communicate with the people in the other university? And why not have these people communicate with the wider community as well? So you have this idea of the course at the center. It's that same picture that I drew earlier, the badly drawn picture. The course at the center shared by many universities. It becomes the nexus for a community, the nexus for a community practice around that particular course. In the far future, courses will be out there on their own. They will have their own management, their own structure, or maybe none. They might be just a self-organizing community that a university taps into. So you sign up for physics at MIT, and your professor says, okay, good. Sign up to the Global Physics Community Network. That's your course. Come back to me when you learn something. Interesting. Makes you wonder why you're paying MIT $35,000 a year. Assessment models are going to change dramatically. Now, already, today, there is commercialized assessment that stands apart from courses. So here's the model, right? And again, this is part of Coursera's plan, part of Udacity's plan. You sign up for your course at MIT. The professor says, here's the worldwide physics community, go there, learn something, come back to me. So you go there. Now you're in the worldwide physics community, you're interacting with all the people, and you're learning from learning objects and watching videos, and then you go back to the MIT professor, and the MIT professor says, okay, now we have an assessment for you. And he sends you to the Washington Post Kaplan Assessment Service, and you do your assessment, and then Kaplan sends back your assessment results to MIT, and MIT gives you a degree, and you've just received an MIT education. Only $34,000. In the far future, this model will be subverted because people will realize that it is ridiculous. In the far future, the idea of an assessment service will make less and less sense because you have been participating in MOOCs. You have been participating in a community. You have shared your content, your communication with other people. You have made connections. They know you. They know your ideas. You begin to develop a reputation in that community. That reputation in the community is your assessment. Now, right now, it's very simplistic. You have clout. It counts the number of Twitter followers and says if you have a large number of Twitter followers, you must be very important. Right? Pretty stupid. Pretty simplistic. That's why I killed my clout account. But imagine if you're using big data network analytics so that if you write a post or you create some content, a system can track the ripple effect of that content through the network, can see the influence you have, can see the pushback that it's created, which is also good. Right? You want people not just to agree with you, but to disagree with you. The worst thing that can happen is if you are ignored. Seeing who is listening to you, seeing who is arguing with you, seeing where you place in that network. Where you place is a set of coordinates. That set of coordinates is your grade. That's assessment of the future. Almost done. I thought he was coming for me. Sustainability. How on earth are we going to pay for this? $34,000 MIT degrees is not going to work. There are many, many people now attempting to defend traditional education with traditional classes and traditional universities, and at the top you have MIT and Stanford and all the same people, right, who take these ideas and commercialize them. And then you have your mid-level universities like Rice and University of Alberta, University of Toronto, and then you have Frank's Garage College, or whatever. This model won't work anymore. This model will be replaced, must be replaced, by a community-based model. And the reason for that is, in the long term, it is the only sustainable model. It's the only way to pay for a system that enables everybody to be educated. Imagine, don't try to think of analogies. Sorry, never mind. What we are going to see developing over time, what we are already seeing develop over time, is this community infrastructure. This is very often the part that is going to be provided by a social service or a government entity, some entity with the resources to create a communications infrastructure and the interest to see it happen. Governments understand the need for communications infrastructure and the need for a certain level of education that is provided to everybody. That is why your government has invested so much in education. That is why my government has invested so much in education. And there's a direct relation between education in society and the level of achievement and the standard of living in that society, which is why governments find it so important. And why, in my mind, they should find it even more important than they do. You will have a commercial there. It would be foolish for me to think that there would not be specialized commercial services. And there will always be competition between these services and the government infrastructure. But that's just, you know, the little bit at the center. The vast bulk of learning will be these communities that are created. It doesn't show up well on that slide. I should rewrite that slide. But the vast bulk of education will be content communities where learning content is created by the learners themselves and then shared with each other. And it's an iterative process, and it's a process that actually feeds into the professional domain of activity. I'll give you an example of what I mean. Climate monitoring will be something that's very important to people in the future. What is the air temperature? What is the rainfall? What is the wind? And we need to get very good, very precise data from a wide number of locations, not just at the airports. People who are experts in climatology would design the system. Professors will be involved. Designers, instrument designers will be involved. The guy who goes out and installs the weather station will be involved. But students as well will be involved. And individual students will play individual roles. And the way to think of climate monitoring as a profession is to think of it as this large network with the experts very tightly connected and interacting at the center, and then loosely connected to professionals, and then more loosely connected to technicians, and even more loosely connected to students. But everybody playing a role in the actual work of measuring the climate. You don't have the artificial climate student center and then the real climate. Everybody's involved in actual climate measuring, actual climate modeling, actual climate prediction. So learning becomes being a member of the profession. Being a member of the profession means being a learner in that profession. Everybody learns, Everybody teaches, everybody creates, everybody consumes, and as a whole, you create your educational system out of this. At the edges, the very edges, you have commercial media, you have commercial support, you have products that people buy, internet access, computers, little weather vanes, things like that have to be paid for. At the center, you have the government infrastructure, the core that makes the entire system possible. But the bulk of learning in this model is the big middle, the donut that is composed of all of society. That's an interesting thought. I just made that up. But that, I just made up that analogy, but that is the model. That is my talk. Those are flowers. I don't know what they're called, but I thought they were interesting. They're just down the road. Thank you so much for your kind attention and your patience, and I know we'll have interesting discussions about these concepts through the day. Thank you very much.
Muchísimas gracias, Stephen. Y en realidad la dinámica será muy interesante, supongo yo, ahora cuando con Diego abramos el conversatorio en torno a los planteamientos de Stephen Downs. Entonces, nos vemos a las... Entonces, como a las 2:10 nos vemos acá. Perfecto. Las preguntas, por favor, las vamos a recoger para tener la base del conversatorio.